At the end of August 2012, a group of artists reached Corniolo, a small village in the Mugello area, not that far from Florence, invited by the collective Radical Intention, together with curator Valeria Del Baglivo, to take part in the Decompression Summer Gathering Camp. A space for communal living and group working, a space for rethinking the processes of production and knowledge transmission, typically used within traditional forms of artistic residencies and workshops. With them, visiting professor Brett Bloom, reasonably considered to be an expert in collective and social practices, artist, writer and editor, founder of the group Temporary Services and member of many other collectives. He got Corniolo with a set of exercises and methods to investigate a few primary aspects of group working. Let's start from listening.
I took quite seriously this challenge from Valerio and Radical Intention to ask ourselves, what does it mean to be living in a neoliberal society? And it has co-opted creativity, it's co-opted all these things that artists do, and ask this question, like, what does it mean to be creative, to gather together, to produce knowledge that doesn't feed a knowledge economy, that doesn't produce some kind of abstract surplus capital, but is really about building community? A lot of the thinking for this week comes from multiple places, multiple people, into exercises that are easy for others to repeat. So I've been working with this group, Temporary Services. There are three of us working together for a number of years, and we try to work in ways that we can share with other people, make models and projects and ideas that are easy to replicate. So everything we're doing this week, the participants in the residency can take these exercises and replicate them themselves. So we look at a variety of kinds of ways of listening. Listening that in some capacity I think is about liberation, whether it's liberating your senses, liberating your subjectivity, or liberating yourself politically. Pauline Oliveros developed the deep listening system over a couple of decades, I mean, really long period of time. This is inspired by it. We're nowhere near the capacity and prowess and amazing insight that she has, but it gives us interesting tools for investigating things very intensely. So the whole idea was to use multiple forms of listening, to experiment with them within a group context, to see what it would draw out of people, how it could make people familiar and comfortable with each other, intimate in a way that wasn't intrusive, that built trust through shared exercises that were not imposed and voluntary. So deep listening teaches you some very basic, profound things about what it means to be something that listens. And listening is very different from hearing. Hearing is something that's located in our ears. Listening is something that has multiple dimensions to it. It includes hearing, but it also includes paying attention to. It's metaphorical in some capacity. For Oliveros, it means a full body experience. It means actually paying attention to how sound hits your body, for example. Sound is a force of energy. It can affect your body in many ways. It can rumble in your belly. It can flicker across your cheek. It can go into your ear. It can also resonate within your mouth. It does these amazing things if you take the time to focus and pay attention. So our first exercise together was just paying attention to what's here already. So we are using another form of listening called the consciousness raising session, developed in a very particular way during the 1970s by the women's movement in the United States. They're based on an older form of self-criticism. The consciousness raising sessions were ways of empowering women, for them to share stories of their common plight, maybe revealing things that they didn't think were oppressive, but through the telling of them and through the coordinating of these stories with other people, they realized that there were patterns that were outside of their control. They could identify them and therefore at least liberate themselves in their minds and start to work towards making social change. So it's a really powerful way of thinking about how to listen to other people, to transform yourself and those within your community through listening, really paying attention to what they're saying, this kind of embodied listening. So very critical to this week is trying to develop some kind of sense of an embodied listening, of a paying attention that is deeper than what we're used to. Another method of listening that we employ is developed by this group called UltraRed. Initially started in Los Angeles, they're a sound art political collective. I always get the definition wrong about what it, they do all these things. But they do these really wonderful public listening sessions, and they take a variety of forms. But one of the forms is something that gets used often in activist practices to generate discussion, a lively discussion. And it's about visualizing people's positions on an issue. It's called discussion on spectrum, I think is what the activists call it, at least the activists in the UK that I've worked with and who've used this methodology. So you just basically draw an imaginary line on the floor. You identify two polar opposite points and you ask people to situate themselves between those two points, and then you get people discussing and you have a debate. It just kind of is a way of activating people and doing it in a very physical way. So we're combining all these methods of listening to each other, doing something that is like deep listening that also leads to a kind of meditation, and then discussing it and sharing some quite intimate personal thoughts, sometimes things you would not say if you did not trust the people you were with. It was very much about creating this safe place for all of us. And one other strategy for listening is just are these group exercises that Temporary Services has developed that help people visualize really complicated patterns in our lives. And it's just an exercise we do based on permaculture, which is a combination of permanent agriculture, an idea developed by Bill Mollison and others in the 1970s and 80s in Australia that looks at holistic ways of farming that are these closed loop cycles that feed themselves and don't produce any waste. So we mapped ourselves, we mapped art culture we're participating in to look at how deeply reliant we are on other people, actually how much labor and energy gets made invisible that goes into the production of the persona of a single artist. So we do an exercise like this. We also do another exercise around our use of language. This other one's about the words we use to name the kinds of groups we exist in. And every person kind of exists within hundreds of groups simultaneously. We do this without thinking about it. People sitting listening to this interview are participating in groups fluently. You know, I'm a father, I'm an artist, I'm a brother, I'm a neighbor. These exercises are really about us paying attention to the groups we rely on to make our world, to feed us, to nurture us, to give us culture, to sustain us, as a way of trying to get beyond and break down the hyper-individualism of a project like neoliberalism, this complete fantasy that an individual can be by him or herself and be self-reliant, that you don't have to rely on other people. It's a complete farce.
The very intimate sense of being part of a group these exercises help to nourish is far away from the current state of artistic labor. Groups are fragmented. People work together in spite of living in different countries and continents.
Working in person is always really preferred situation, but it's not always possible given the pressures we have on us in contemporary society. I work with Mark Fisher and Salem Kalajulin in Temporary Services, and we live in three different cities. It's very unsatisfying, but the language that we've built up over the years from living on the same street for many years, having instant access to each other most of the time, it's hard to let that shared language go that we built up, and it's something that's still growing. It is across these larger distances now. We see each other once or twice a year in person and then try to work intensely in that situation. This is symptomatic of, I think, a lot of the pressures that most of us feel. I had to move out of the United States for a job because the economy is so miserable. So I moved to Denmark for a job so I could continue to be an artist in the way I wanted to. It's quite a dignified way in which the Danes treat their artists, at least for the time being. It's probably changing very soon. So we have these pressures that have kind of globalized our economy, sending factories overseas, sending jobs elsewhere. There's a lot of pressure on you to move, to be flexible, to be mobile, and it's not desirable. I don't like it. I think it's important to ask ourselves these questions you asked, to think about these things, also to kind of deal with the reality that we've been handed and try to build something else up. I think group work is a very satisfying way of coping with this, and I think in one part why so many people are doing it now, it's this breakdown of our communities, this hyper-individualization, this kind of like, you don't have to be in an art group. I think like individuals are feeling this.
Beside the idea of group working as an empowering tool to cope with the vices of the neoliberal society, to talk about collaborative projects can't elude certain individual competitive tendencies. It is necessary to raise questions around competitions, tensions, and disagreement handling within the group, around the relations between competition and creativity. You might start from Against Competition, an essay written by Brett Bloom's Temporary Services co-founder, Mark Fisher.
Well, the article starts out, it's written by Mark Fisher, who works with Salem and I in Temporary Services. It starts out with a story of a young artist from Ireland writing to Mark. He's really upset. He was working on a project. His professor told him, oh, you can't really do that because this Mark Fisher guy over here has already done that. Maybe you should talk to him about it, get permission, see if it's okay. And Mark was overjoyed to have contact with this guy to talk about this nerdy obsession with collecting images that look in a very particular kind of way. Mark talked to the guy, said, look, I made this years ago. You live in Ireland. Probably nobody's really going to know I did this. Here's all my research on this. Have it. Take it. And part of the thinking behind this, and something we talk about all the time in temporary services, we see our peers, we see our colleagues trying to hide and protect and gather their knowledge, like kind of like a squirrel holding a nut very close so the other squirrels can't get it. We talk about this activity as really kind of crippling you as an artist. If you're working from a place of fear of your peers, you don't have anybody to talk to really deeply about your concerns. And it limits the ways in which you can be creative. You have somebody there sitting there protecting an idea, holding it close. How long do they hold on to it? How long do they care for it? How long do they hide it away from others? Well, for us, it's like, okay, have this idea. We're going on to 50 other ideas. We're on our way. We're going to find something even better. We trust this. This is a part of being an artist. It's really important. It's really about honestly assessing how creativity functions, you know? If you think about language, none of us owns language, even though you can get patents and copyrights for the ways in which you organize it. But we all rely on millions of other people going before us, using the language, perfecting it, tasting it, exercising it, really trying it out before we even get to put it in our mouths, right? So it's like, it's the same with artistic ideas. So it's a really simple thing. And I think that there's an enormous amount of work to get us to not reflect on it in this way, because thinking in this way doesn't serve a power structure that extracts value from things that really shouldn't be valued, this kind of behavior. So we need people in a way that where this kind of competition is corrosive, it hurts us, it makes us fear one another, it destroys the possibility for something completely different. So within temporary services, we work through ideas really quickly. This is the beauty of group work. You know, if there are flaws in an idea, or if it's not fully drawn out, or, you know, in my case, it might always be so overtly political that it's just dumb, and I need one of them to say, like, oh, Brett, you're doing it again. Stop it so we can move forward. We all need that kind of feedback to move really quickly through our limits and, yeah, our limited ways of thinking about things. So the group process can give you this built-in feedback structure that you don't really get as a solo artist. Right, there's an ethics to group working, and this is something we've spent time talking about during the decompression camp. There's always an implicit power structure in every human grouping. You can't avoid it. It's always going to naturally appear. Several responses are possible. Either you do nothing and you just let it take over and flourish, or you thoughtfully try to mitigate personalities and find structures that benefit everybody. This is kind of vaguely what democracy is supposed to be. It's like making a collective of individuals and everybody benefits and it's ethical and healthy. Well, we know that doesn't exist. So group work is a way, in some capacities, to approximate that. Every group is going to articulate this differently. That makes it messy to think about. That makes it messy to talk about. People dismiss it because of that reason. There's really not very good critical writing about group work. The people who usually end up doing the writing have never worked in this way, don't have the deep insights into the very rewarding and also very frustrating things that come out of this way of working. Because there aren't guides to this, because there isn't a culture supporting group work, a lot of it is unknown. A lot of this training has to be shared orally, or in our case, we made a book of stories of the positive, negative, and other aspects to working in these ways, the joys of it, the real extreme highs, and also the very devastating lows that can come with it. You have to talk through the power structures that are implicit in human gatherings. In our case, we're two men and one woman. In contemporary American society, you have to talk about that power dynamic. You can't just let it go. There's going to be issues, whether they're external or internal. We also had to deal with racism and sexism externally directed towards our group. It wasn't coming from us, but people were projecting it onto us. We had to deal with that. You have all this pressure from the outside. There's a whole range of conversations and instructions and process that needs to be made more explicit about this way of working, but it's not coming from schools. People teaching in schools, even if they're like me, who's committed to this way of working, I teach and I have this barrier. School's about producing individuals. They're there, they're kind of constructed as consumers before they come in. They fine-tune themselves and they go out and repeat this exercise ad infinitum. And there isn't a school I know of that takes in groups, trains groups, really reflects on what a group is. It just doesn't exist, and then puts them out in the world. Like, since we started, things have gotten marginally better for people working in groups, but we still have to fight to make sure we're all paid a decent wage for an exhibition if there's pay, instead of all three of us splitting the fee of one artist. So, or all three of us traveling when it's possible for an exhibition, rather than only one person getting to go. We have to make lots of decisions. Sometimes there isn't the budget for that, but there's a lot to negotiate. The culture doesn't support what we do.
Among the many projects Temporary Services have initiated, Off-Letter Press is a publishing imprinting and an experimental online store born to publish and distribute book and publication by themselves and others. Off-Letter Press is not the only online publishing platform dealing with artistic publications. Just let's list a few: printed matter and publishing and occasional paper. And in the last few years, there has been an explosion in printed matter as an artistic mean.
Yeah, it's not new at all, but there is a profound resurgence of artists printing things now. I've really noticed in the past 5 years this dramatic increase, and there are more artist book fairs popping up all over the place. There's been an explosion in print. Right when we're hearing that print is dead, right? The book is obsolete. Newspapers don't exist. I mean, we know this is not true. Like, something is shifting. Somebody has an interest in that narrative proliferating. But we were sitting talking with one person in the decompression camp today who's a publisher herself about comments a visitor to the camp made about how she only reads novels when she travels on her Kindle because it's really horrible for critical books or historical books because she can't mark it up. She can't leave traces of her thoughts in it. Yeah, you can highlight and write some notes, but it's not the same as circling something really vigorously and writing, scribbling notes in all the margins and like really seeing that as you flip through a book. You can't hold an electronic book in your head. It's not there. You can hold your favorite book in your head and you can remember kind of what that passage looks like, where there was that idea that's fleeting that you want to communicate, and you know you can find it if you just spend 5 minutes, and it's exactly in this terrain here. You remember its location in a book. There's all these things that the ebook tries to steal from us, right? There's this impoverishment that's going on. Unless we take a dual path, you don't have to say, like, you don't have to be Luddite and kind of reject one for the other. I think that you can find the joys and pleasures in both and celebrate both, like have both. I much prefer to smell my books, to feel their heft, you know, the weight and size. So we do a lot of stuff with electronic books, actually, but it's turning rare books or out of print books or books that people are protecting for monetary reasons that really should circulate. We make PDFs and we circulate them. Making PDFs has really become a new form of publishing for a lot of people. Some people do really elegant pirated PDFs. Like, every little chapter is annotated and you can click and it goes immediately there. It's a kind of a beautiful experience when somebody has crafted a PDF. So we try to pay attention to these things. But I think people want to feel textures, want to see vibrant colors, want to see how a magnetic purple shimmers as you turn the page, as opposed to just being represented on a flat screen. People want to feel different kinds of cardstock and different weights of paper, and to just get this range of sensations that you get when something is actually printed. I think that this explosion in printing is also a response. I've said neoliberalism too many damn times so far, so I'm going to stop saying it, but I think that the printing is just kind of a natural response. People want to make things. I also think, too, and I've had this conversation with many people, that printing is a way for those of us who feel like we're attached to a conceptual tradition to actually make really good-looking things, right? Conceptual art kind of broke the mold of contemporary art. It was extremely dry. It was typed on pieces of paper that were tacked to the wall. It was scrawled on the wall. It wasn't very aesthetically pleasing. Too many people making social practice, socially engaged art, whatever you call it, still hold on to the aesthetics, the information aesthetics of the 1970s. While we have long histories of print, we also have new technologies. We can make really good looking things that also kind of still have the conceptual weight, kind of merging this sort of craft, this craft of making with this craft of thinking.
This interview was recorded in Corniolo, Mugello, Toscana, at the end of August 2012. RadioPapesse.org.